You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find other episodes of The View and to subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org/VUU.
Good morning and welcome to The View. We are so glad that you could join us here. We've got a few of our regulars and some guests joining us. I'm the Reverend Joanna Fontaine Crawford. I'm here in Austin, Texas. There was a recent conference for UUs of Color. Who all was at that?
Well, Carlton and
I, of our panel here.
Yeah, Carlton and I were there. Aisha, we missed you tremendously.
It was probably a lot quieter with that. Usually I'm screaming through the halls, so it's
probably
a lot quieter.
You know, it's funny. We actually kind of took shifts. To just yell incoherently.
And that's so, awesome.
You know, just take an hour and a half here and there. So we had that covered, but that's a lot of work.
It is.
Yeah, but it was cool. So it's for you ministers, seminarians, religious educators, administrators of color, and musicians as well. And yeah, it was our biggest gathering ever. What, 80-something, Carlton, I think?
Yeah, close to 90, I think it was. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's just,
yeah, it was really,
it's amazing to get together and, you know, have deep spiritual moments and then also just yell and sing in the hallways. So, good combination of stuff.
Everything that I saw posted about it was just glowing and talking about how important this was, and I think also for each individual, how much it meant. How do you kind of bring that back home with you?
Well, yeah, Carlton, go for it.
I'd say that it builds over many years. It's been the Finding Our Way Home gathering, which is what it's called, has been going on for about, I think more than 10 years now, 11 or 12 years perhaps. Mm-hmm. And it started out relatively small, like 30 people who were there, and it's continued to grow. And so what I would say is that for me, I feel like I'm carrying the community with me wherever I go, and for me it becomes sort of like a spiritual touchstone, because so often if we're like a General Assembly, you know, you look across the sea of all the wonderful people at General Assembly, and there'll be like a person of color here, a person of color there, but then you have a different experience when, you know, you thin it out and it's just, you know, that core group of people that's left. It's very moving. The thing that I would say, just to give you like a little taste of some of the things that happened there, we had a chance to pay tribute to Reverend Orlando Brignola, who was a very faithful participant in that community, someone who died very suddenly, I would say, just a few weeks ago. And there was tremendous respect for her. She was based primarily out of New York, was very strong in her social justice stance, and was regularly present there at Finding Our Way Home. Had a chance to go to First Unitarian Church of Philadelphia and to breathe in some of that history. I actually left a little bit before that part of the program was over because I had to get to a conference in Atlanta. But just being in that space where Frances Ellen Watkins Harper was, Theodore Parker, it's just a really powerful and moving experience as well. Then we had a chance to go and be outside in front of Church of the Restoration there in Philadelphia, along with the regular rally that they do each week with regards to Black Lives Matter. And just feeling the support and the love coming from that local community was really tremendous, different from other communities where they've had their signs vandalized or taken down, their heads paint splashed upon them. People were honking in celebration as we were standing outside, and then we went inside for a very moving vigil, recognizing those lives that have been lost to violence and brutality, particularly by the police. So, yeah, very, very rich and moving experience all around.
Yeah, I was seeing pictures of that, and it looked like the regulars were awfully grateful to have y'all there, too.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah.
So in the big world of UU, Hank, I know that you are very busy right now. What's going on?
Oh my gosh, it's busy. No, yeah, it's it's busy at the church I'm serving, the First Parish Church in Milton, Massachusetts, because they are about to announce their candidate for ministry in a few days, and so like this Sunday, it's candidating week begins the 24th. So this Sunday, I said, we're going to clean up the church. So that's basically what we're doing. But the big thing, of course, is what you're really talking about. Everyone is talking about is the Hot Stove Report, which is a website that I run where we keep track of everyone who has been called to ministry and to churches in search, and we, you know, and I sort of say like, hey, who's going where, that sort of thing, and it started last Sunday with people being announced. Actually, it started last Thursday. We had one announcement last Thursday, but for the most part, everyone else has been announcing from Sunday on. And it's great. It's great seeing our colleagues get churches. It's great seeing churches really get some wonderful ministers. And it's always interesting to sort of see who people are. Try to imagine like, oh, how will that be with them there, and being excited. And you know, it also keeps us old timers it keeps me in contact with younger ministers and people coming out of seminary more recently. Because I get to meet them and at least online, and get a chance to sort of interact with them when I find out where they're going and stuff, and I also get to celebrate with friends I've known for years. Speaking of the first Unitarian in Philadelphia, an old friend Abby Tennis has been invited to be the candidate there, and so that's very exciting for her and for the Philadelphia church. And so it's like all these things are going on. It's interesting, certainly seeing the number of women going into larger pulpits. Robin Tanner has been invited to be the candidate at the Summit Church in Summit, New Jersey, which is a wonderful church. Though their previous minister was a woman as well. And then Jennifer Nordstrom has been invited to be the candidate in Milwaukee, and which is, of course, the home of Fonzie and the rest of the gang from Happy Days. I don't know if they're Unitarian Universalists or not, but I'm very happy. I'm happy to claim them if we want to make a T-shirt. I will at least get a Jennifer, like at least next to the big bronze statue of Fonzie that they have there in Milwaukee. It's great seeing the number of women being called to larger pulpits, which really hadn't been happening until the last few years in great numbers. And something that some of us were speaking about before we went live, the number of ministers of color, however, haven't gone up to being called to congregations, though we're still only not even halfway through the announcement. So, but it's it's something that I think that really needs to happen for our faith to keep growing and progressing forward.
So there was also a board report, a UUA board report recently, right, where President Peter Morales gave some pretty stark numbers. Can you speak to that?
Just a little bit. He talked about that this year there were 70 churches, 75 churches in search, if you count churches who are looking for settled ministers or looking in developmental ministries. There's probably another six churches looking for assistant ministers, and there were only about 90, so let's say 70 churches in search and about 90 ministers who are looking for positions, and it ends up that there were about 15 churches that ended up not having settled a minister in this first round. There's sort of two rounds of search, and so there's folks who congregations that are still looking, and of those 15, 12 of them were in congregations of 150 or less, and it certainly looks like our smaller congregations are the ones who are taking the hit right now, and especially small congregations in areas that are not in big cities. I think that's the other part of it too that you see. Aisha asked about the different rounds of So the search process usually takes a year, and then the interview stage usually runs from January until into March. And if a church comes up not having found a settled minister, they are able to spend another, I can't remember if it's a month or 6 weeks, doing sort of it's not quite speed dating, but they are going to do this. But it really, you know, I'm not sure if all these churches will be able to settle someone this year. And also there is a shortage of interim ministers, and so many of the churches, I'm certainly wondering if there will be enough interim ministers for the congregations that need them, and sometimes ministers are able to go and stay someplace, and if they're already an interim, you can usually stay perhaps an extra year, but sometimes you can't. I'm going to let you guys talk. I'm getting a phone call from my daughter's school. Hang on a second.
Okay. Live TV. Carlton, I know you're on the Congregational Life staff. What is the fallout from this? Or, you know, is this something that you have to deal with, these churches that thought that they were going to get a minister? Are they giving calls to the region and saying, what do we do now?
Yeah, I can speak to that. I want to correct something I said earlier, though. As I was talking about the first church in Philadelphia, I said Theodore Parker. I meant to say Joseph Priestley, who's the famous Unitarian minister associated with that church. I wanted to just correct that. Yes, as a regional staff, we do get those calls from congregations that are very concerned about what's happening during the process as they're looking for a minister. And we do get those calls. Congregations want to know, well, what do we do now? Starting to feel a bit anxious around that. And what we really encourage congregations to do is to trust in the process and trust that whichever minister is going to be ideally suited for their congregation is out there for them. And I think it is a reality that we're having to consider, though, as we go forward in our movement and as communities and communities become more and more secular, the communities surrounding churches, I think it becomes that much more important for churches to be engaged and involved in partnerships with each other, to build support within clusters, to look at, so we have congregations that are doing multi-sites as a way of addressing the needs of those smaller churches as well. It is something that has an impact on us as regional staff, but we continue to coach congregations and encourage them as they're in these anxious moments together.
I'm sure there will be more information about that coming. I will say, the MFC was meeting last week, too, so there should be a new crop of brand new ministers that can join in second round of search. So moving on to our topic, tell me a little bit about what is happening with Black Lives of UU right now. And I guess, Carlton, you and I were kind of chatting earlier about one of the intersectionalities.
Yes, we were talking about that. One of the things that has our attention now are the issues that are going on in North Carolina as well as in Mississippi. The legislation that has been passed that's making it very difficult for trans people to be in those states. We had actually hoped to have Michael Slack on this on the View again today. He wasn't feeling well and wasn't able to join us. Hope he's going to be feeling better real soon. But he's one of those. He's one of our ministers who's serving in North Carolina, and was actually at Finding Our Way Home the other week, and is in the impact of this anti-trans legislation as well. And what we say inside of Black Lives Matter, and one of the first principle of Black Lives that we put together, those of us on the organizing collective, is that all Black Lives Matter. Which includes Black women's lives, Black trans lives, Black elders' lives, and on down that line. And certainly we're very concerned about anything that would have Black trans people be at risk or be in danger of being harassed or not being able to have their personal needs met when they need to relieve themselves. It's really a terrible thing. I mean, I just imagine what it must be like as I'm a cisgender man, but what it must be like for people who can't go to relieve themselves in the bathroom because for fear of like what other people might say or do to them, might even be at risk of physical harm. So that's forefront in our minds, and we know that particularly trans women and trans women of color and Black trans women even more specifically are at risk of losing their lives and are at constant risk of harassment. And there have been deaths of Black trans women already this year. So that's something that's an ongoing concern. So that's one of the things that we're going to be touching on by the time we get to General Assembly this summer as well.
Yeah, some of these stories that we're seeing right now, you know, where they're trying to make rules even about children, trans children using the restroom. And I would assume that this is just playing into another trope, you know, the whole trope of the Black man as dangerous predator. When you then add this issue of trans onto it, that it's just oppression on top of oppression on top of oppression.
Exactly, and it keeps multiplying. So, so what we're going to be doing is to be in conversation with folks at General Assembly about how we can continue to make it safer for all participants, including the trans folks who are going to be there as well, and how we can support and provide sustenance for people as they're coming. And I think it means trying to prepare people who might be coming to General Assembly for the first time as to what General Assembly culture is like, because I know that we've got people coming from places where, you know, they don't even know from transgender anything. We have people coming from congregations and communities where there are literally like no Black people, or virtually no Black people. So
there are UU churches with no Black people?
As surprising as that seems,
more to love.
I tell you, it's true. It is the case. So, really, you know, figuring out like how we're going to provide support for all of the people who will be participating in General Assembly and making it as you know as safe a place as possible. But that really has a lot to do with people who are going to be arriving and coming prepared to engage with people from a diversity of perspectives. What we often talk about inside the Southern region is how people relate to difference and what it means to be someone who's in a relative place of privilege with regards to difference and someone who's in a disadvantaged space, and how it's actually the responsibility of those in the relatively privileged coming from a relatively privileged place to adjust themselves and to do what they need to do to make it more equitable for everyone who's involved.
I know that there is a program this year to try and get more Black UUs to GA for the first time. And this issue, I mean, for anyone, the very first time you go to GA, right, it's a huge learning curve of just, you know, what is the, oh my God, there's, you know, 3,000 people singing Spirit of Life, you know. From those really basic things to the more serious things, and of course the history that we have had at GA around race, is there anything that is being done to prepare someone for what this big picture thing is like?
Can I add to that question? Another question is how, because what's jumping into my mind is the inevitable microaggressions that happen from the well-meaning white liberal UUGA attendees, which for first-time folks of color that attend, it's startling, hurtful. So it almost feels like I want to write a top 10, please be mindful not to be part of these microaggressions. And then for folks of color, you may hear some of these. I don't know. So I'm thinking of that, too.
So jump in. Any of those questions?
Okay. Well, Carlton's giving me the look, so it looks like I'm up. All right. So yeah. I mean, I think there's multiple levels. So there's affordability. And then, and I think, Carlton, you're probably a little better equipped to talk about the specifics of our plan. So if you're not, you got like 90 seconds to get ready. So, but yeah, no, I think as far as like the preparation of GA, you know, these are things, first of all, that, you know, if you're a black UU, you're probably not totally unprepared, you know, for the either, you know, it's like you walk in, you walk or glide into the doors of a UU church and you either are sometimes either ignored or overly praised for being there. Oh gosh, there's a black person, or oh my gosh, there's a black person at last, you know, we have made it. Our plan has worked, you know, that's sometimes...
Can we put you on the front page of our website?
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, but what I would say as well is that a lot of what we're hoping to do on our end as Black Lives of UU organizers is to shift the status quo to, with our programming, but also with social time, with, you know, possibly inviting folks to, you know, find each other at general session, you know, when we're all in the big room, or for, you know, when we hear from Krista Tippett for the Ware lecture, things like that, to where it's not only like, yeah, there's going to be microaggressions and you're going to get called Razeek Brown even if you don't have dreads, and if you're going to get called Janice Marie Johnson even if you're, you know, a 6'2 black woman, like whatever, it's just going to happen. And how do we also change the experience? And part of that is having more black UUs there, so that the feel is different. And so that's something that we're pretty hard at work at the moment. And, you know, we want to see more people of color more broadly as well. So, so accepting the status quo, shifting the status quo, that's kind of what we're doing in advance. And then, Carlton, if you want to talk a little bit more about kind of the other side of this effort, because it's really a multifaceted approach.
One question I wanted to ask, because I've heard this mentioned before, is about creating a like a healing place for black UUs. So let me throw, if either of you can speak to that too.
Yeah, I can speak to that. Well, one of the things that we realized is that so often inside of Unitarian Universalism, there are opportunities for people to be wounded and to have the experience of pain because of black, being identified as black, being known as black, being confused about people, as Kenny was just saying, being assumed to be someone who doesn't belong there, someone who's of ill intent. So we're being intentional about creating a space and even a room within the convention center where black youths will be able to gather together, to reflect, to be in conversation with one another, and also to be in conversation with ministers as well, who might be able to speak to the issues and the situations that they're facing. I know that, you know, for some Unitarian Universalists who find themselves in white congregations with white ministers, even just the opportunity to engage with a black minister or a black, some other black religious professional is a rare opportunity. So we want to, you know, be available and accessible to people in that regard too. And I'd say another part of the healing space that we're providing that's going to be different from other General Assemblies, as we mentioned before, and hopefully people are beginning to conceptualize it more broadly, is that there will be conversations that will be explicitly black, held in explicitly black spaces, explicitly other people of color spaces, and explicitly white ally spaces. So, that's going to be different too. Some of the conversations that we have have content in them that are really sensitive for those of us who are black identified, and rather than to enter into that conversation in a space where we're going to be viewed and perceived by white people through our blackness, we're choosing instead to create a space where that is a that's not going to be an issue, which is not different from when women have opted to create women-only spaces inside of our association as well. So, and it's not like, and there's not going to be like a paper bag test or anything like that, you know, based on, you know, what people, it's not so much based on what people look like, it's who your people are, who your ancestors are, your recent ancestors, and how you identify in the world that determines, you know, whether someone is a candidate to be in the explicitly black spaces. So we're trusting and hoping that and encouraging our Unitarian Universalists more broadly to bring an open mind to this approach and to understand it as a context for healing.
So going back to this question that I had had before about the conference and how you bring that home, are there any thoughts about with GA about how the people who are coming to GA for the first time can then take some of that home, perhaps be connected with mentors or, you know, things like that?
Yeah, so, you know, the interesting thing about you know, take finding our way home in Philadelphia last month, you know, it's this fascinating thing where you have folks like Rosemary Bray McNadd and, you know, Cheryl M. Walker and these legends, you know, these people that you just, you know, if you're, you know, you who's been on the national scene, you're just like, wow. And how watching them, you know, come up to me or come up to other black folks in their 20s, other people of color who are, they may not be in their 20s, but they may be newer to the movement, and just the genuine excitement that they bring to the fact that we are here. You know, I'll never forget my first finding our way home. You know, I was like John Creswell and Rosemary Bray McNadd are excited to meet me. Like, wait, what? I mean, you know, I watched their sermons online or, you know, read their stuff in UU World. And I think similarly, even if, you know, if you're a black UU or other new UU who's like, doesn't know those names, those folks, Aisha too, I mean, those folks, they're going to find you. They're going to connect because they're excited to see you, not just because like, oh yeah, there's more of us, yay, but also because they're excited to know what you bring. And I think, you know, for us as Black Lives of UU organizers, it's not just about what programming we put on or what our workshops are, but it's providing space, whether it's explicitly black space or some other kind of space, providing space for those connections to happen. Because that, when you go back to your UU church where you're one of six people of color or one of three, you know, to know that like such and such person, Carlton Elliott Smith, is like looking out for you, or Aisha is looking out for you, or whoever it is, that stuff makes all the difference in the world. So that's a big part of what we're trying to do.
And I think for if I can jump in, what I my first Finding Our Way Home, I want to say, was 2008. It might have been the first year that religious educators were invited. It was interesting how it happened in steps. It was first ministers and seminarians of color for a few years, and then religious educators of color, and then a few years after that, then it was opened up to religious professionals who work for UU congregations, which all of them are predominantly white. And the relationship building is not to be underestimated. When I've posted, we have a Facebook page, and we used to have a listserv, and if I post I'm struggling with something, Carlton, God bless you, will always have a special place in my heart, because he's genuinely the first person to call me. And he'll call and say, I'm here for you, what do you need? And just to have that, and Carlton and I don't think we've ever lived in the same state at the same time. When, by the time you got to Jersey, I think I was in New Hampshire, and now you're in Mississippi. Oh. But having and knowing I can just email Kenny and say, hey, you know, here are my thoughts, or Sophia Betancourt, Rosemary, Cheryl, helps strengthen Unitarian Universalism in the big picture, because we're sticking with it. If I wasn't empowered to talk to the people who understand the challenges of being in a predominantly white denomination, and as a leader in a predominantly white denomination, I don't know that I would have stayed as long. I just don't. And I'm not saying that as a cop-out. It's just because it's genuinely exhausting. And so creating, as Kenny said, a new status quo, creating a new paradigm, to me is part of how we are going to not just strengthen Unitarian Universalism, but make it relevant. Make it relevant to the religion we say we want to be, the people who we say we want to be. And for me, Finding Our Way Home is a huge... it lives in me. You know, I feel like it's a living, breathing entity, and it's just not to be underestimated. And what I love about Black Lives of UU, and it was a light bulb moment for me when I saw Selma, is that there needs to be space for the American Black experience. It is not the same as, I'm an immigrant, so I've had the immigrant experience. And I'm an ally to the Black Lives of UU and the Black Lives movement. Because, yes, we have an umbrella of people of color, but we all have, I mean, the Black experience needs to be lifted up, recognized, and there needs to be reconciliation on a major scale. Almost especially within Unitarian Universalism, because we've always thought ourselves as different. So,
And I would add to that you talk about creating the faith that we say we are, and to me, part of that is, you know, one of my biggest pet peeves is when folks talk about a UU is a white faith, and like predominantly white, sure, but I mean, a lot of times, like when you know. When we come together at Finding Our Way Home, or when we come together as people of color at GA, like those spaces aren't just Black spaces or people of color spaces. They're Unitarian Universalist spaces. And that's especially important because a lot of times folks, folks believe that, or they come in as people of color, they come in as Black UUs, and they kind of feel like an outcast everywhere, including in predominantly Black spaces. And so, you know, a lot of times you can talk about UUs as sort of this place for people who didn't quite fit in somewhere else. And I think certainly goes for me, I'll speak from my own experience, that, you know, feeling like I was worried about, like, could I have Black friends? Could I have other friends of color? You know, so used to growing up around white people. And a lot of times when UUs of color get together, Black UUs get together, it's about like, oh my gosh, this space is the most at home I've ever felt. You know, that some other predominantly Black space, because you don't share the theology of most folks in the room, or don't share the experiences, or you're much more used to being around white people and white cultural, predominantly white cultural norms, that like that space, is incredibly important for us. And so, yeah, I just like, we are not a white faith, we're a predominantly white faith, and for the work we do, it's about, you know, helping folks who maybe feel always a little bit uncomfortable find their home. So,
right. I mean, I think, you know, most of us at some point have met some person who has walked into our church and you know, after one Sunday has done the whole, oh, this is my religion that I always was but never knew about. Mm-hmm. I would assume that then being able to take that feeling and be at something like Finding Our Way Home is just this whole other level of that. So I'm curious about the networking that is happening. Is it just kind of organic, or is there kind of a master plan to make sure that people of color have someone that they can reach out to? Okay, Kenny. Yeah.
I was being a little silly. Carlton, you look like you have... So.
Master plan. Okay, yeah. Master plan may sound a little too twirling the mustache.
Good, yes.
What's the character in Austin Powers? The Dr. Evil. That's a Dr. Evil move, right? Networking. The answer to your question is yes. It's happening in both an informal way as well as a more formalized way, and hopefully we'll be able to do more of that going forward. What Kenny and Aisha was saying is true, that we are reaching out to one another in informal ways in times of need, whether it's on Facebook or picking up the phone or calling or texting or however we're gonna do that and connect with one another. And then as we get deeper into it, and there's going to be the opportunities for us to do like more mapping across the country, such that, you know, if you're in Lafayette, Louisiana, as a person of color, you know who the people, or as a Black person, you know who the Black people are in Baton Rouge, and you could start to have people cluster in those ways as well, and provide opportunities to connect. There's already been a history and a tradition of people of color gathering inside of the association. I mean, going back to the empowerment Black Empowerment era as well. And in more recent years, we've had DRUM, the Diverse Revolutionary Unitarian Universalist Multicultural Ministries, gatherings that have happened regionally and nationally as well. So all of that is going to be continuing to go forward. But yes, I'm excited about the possibility of being able to empower people, that once people know that there's more help out there than they knew of, that people are going to be able to meet face-to-face on a more regular basis and be able to be active and support one another in that way, too.
Is there a way that allies can help with this? And I'm thinking of, you know, back in our conversation where we talked about, you know, yes, there are some all-white churches. So a person of color walks in, becomes a member. Is there some sort of way that you would recommend that they can get this information?
That's such a great question. I think we're going to be able to focus a bit more of that by the time we get to the other side of General Assembly. Just so much of the focus and the energy is going now to preparing for that. Those are some of the questions that we're hoping to respond to by the time we get to General Assembly, in fact. And there are going to be opportunities where it's going to be white allies, other people of color, and black folks in the room together, thinking about how we do this work going forward, or how we're going to support one another. And we're going to have a two-hour workshop block on Saturday afternoon at GA to address that very thing. And I think coming out of that, we'll have more specific recommendations for how allies within congregations and congregations that identify as allies can also participate. But I would say for those congregations that have already taken the leap to be publicly identified as behind Black Lives Matter, that in itself has been a tremendous help and boon and given a lot of energy to Black Unitarian Universalists across the country. So to the allies who are behind that in their respective congregations, thank you so much.
And I would just add really quickly, Joanna, that I think connecting folks with us, with Carlton and me, with Leslie and Lena and Alandria, I think that, you know, that's, you know, as we hopefully become a faith that has more people of color, more black folks in different spaces, you know, there was a black woman in Florida about my age who submitted a piece to UU World about her experience as a black UU and feeling all alone. She doesn't know that I run the submissions page, fun fact. So, like, I read it, and I just sent her an email. It was like, wow, you know, let's chat. And lo and behold, like, now she's connected to the Black Lives of UU Facebook group, our own Facebook group. And so, you know, in the meantime, as we come up with a more official next moves statement, I think that part of it will be just, you know, informally making connections. And so if you're listening or watching us and, you know, please do connect with connect folks in your congregation if they seem interested. I think first check with that. That's an important part.
Right.
Of
like, don't let, are you saying that we shouldn't just rush at every person of color and say...
Yeah, you should talk to... But if someone's asking, you know, so what's the larger narrative here? Like, what... Then at that point, I think it's a great call to... Because the organizing collective is very tapped into different parts of UUism in different parts of the country. So, yeah, that's another way as we continue to formalize, you know, what our next moves are going to be. So.
And Kenny, are you going to be giving any workshops at GA?
GA. Oh gosh, it's going to be awful.
Are you going to be sleeping at all during? GA?
I will not likely. I'll try to fit in a few hours here and there. So I'm involved in four workshops, but the one I suspect you're asking about is the Black Lives of UU history workshop. So what we're hopeful to do is, you know, one of the great things about Mark Morrison Reed is that his work, getting those stories of Black Universalists and Unitarians going back to the early 20th century, and also stories of folks in Selma. And so what we're hoping to do is kind of take his work, but also take work from Reverend Dr. Kiyama and from other folks who have done this work and make it come alive at a history workshop at GA. I think it's the second of our track. and, you know, to talk about the history, but also like the current, that we are making history as Black UUs. So we're going to talk about the painful stuff like the Black empowerment controversy, but also the exciting stuff that there's history happening now. And so I just feel like I'm really excited about this, because part of this work is helping folks, helping Black UUs around the country feel part of a larger whole, that you are not the only person to experience the struggles, you're not the only person to experience the joys of being, of finding this faith, but also like, okay, well, I love this theology, I love the people, and it's tiring to be one of two Black families, that there is a legacy here. And that's true if you're a religious educator, that's true if you're a minister. And so when we talk about the history session, we're really talking about connecting to that which is larger than us. And so that's what we're going to be doing, and I'm really pumped about the program we're putting together.
Are there parts of our, I would say, painful parts of our recent history, Fort Worth is what comes to mind, that you feel that we should be, I mean, like, when I was preparing for the MFC, like, the Black empowerment controversy, like, you need to be able to understand that. Are there things since then that you feel that we need to tell the stories of?
Yeah, I mean, and so we're going to talk about the you know, the Thomas Jefferson ball in the 90s. I'm sure that'll definitely come up. And if you're a listener and are familiar with that, there's easily findable resources online that kind of talk about, you know, if you have a ball that's like, please come in period dress, you know, like, what does that mean if you are a Black person being asked to join an 18th century, well, how should I dress, you know? So that is that sort of thing. But the goal is to equip our folks with history. But I think I said that was in the 90s, right? The Thomas Jefferson ball. I'm pretty sure it was. Yeah. But to equip folks with the realities of what's happened, but also to do two things. One is that you don't have to go all the way back to the 60s to find pain. But also, you can go back to the 60s and find joy. You can go to the 90s and find joy, joyous stories of Black Universalists and Unitarians. And that there's a lot to celebrate here. So we're going to, you know, I don't think folks are going to leave that history session like, oh gosh, you know.
That's it. I'm going to go join right, another
topic. Yeah. Yeah. So I don't think that's going to be the case, because for every time, you know, something like the Thomas Jefferson ball or 2005 Fort Worth GA happens, there's this response and there's this communal coming together with Black UUs, with other UUs of color, and with really every UU who's committed to this work and saying, okay, how are we going to do better? And I think that's what's happening now, is a recognition of our history combined with, you know, how are we going to keep pushing forward to build a better future?
I know something that we often will say is, you know, oh, well, I'm not attached to the outcome, but are there any outcomes of this GA that you're really hoping for?
Yes. So I'll just speak very quickly. One is, I want folks to say, there are a lot of Black folks here. That's one of our goals. Is our goal 300, Carlton? Is that our goal?
Yes.
300 Black UUs. So we're doing at least. Which would be a record by 90, 100, something like that. I think we did the numbers, and it certainly would be a new record for us. It's certainly in recent history, but also, so, you know, when that happens, you know, part of, so I live near Boulder, which is, you know, one of the great white liberal havens, and people love to talk about how progressive it is, and one of the things that happens is when you ramp up the number of Black folks or number of people of color in a space, you know, suddenly you can no longer avoid thinking about, if you're a white person, you can no longer avoid thinking about, like, you know, it brings something up, right? This is like the tipping point phenomenon. And so, you know, for me personally, it's about, no, let's have the tension, let's have the hard conversations, let's, like, because when you notice there's a lot of Black folks, what does that do for you? What's happening within? And, you know, I don't want to do that just for the white people's growth by any stretch, but I think it will help us as a whole faith kind of come to terms with that we got a lot of work to do. Because you hear that a lot, well, at least we're not Mississippi passing these laws, at least we're not North Carolina. It's like, no, we are, wherever you are, there's racial work to be done. So I just wanted to say that, and then, yeah, please, others add
it. Discomfort can be a very, you know, can be gross.
Mm-hmm.
Carlton, what about you? Do you have any outcomes you're hoping for?
Similar to some of the things that Kenny was saying, I'm really hoping that this is an on-ramp for people to become more deeply involved and more deeply committed to the work that we're doing inside of our association. That so often I think Unitarian Universalists, I've observed over the years, and even in myself, can be goal-oriented. It's like we want the gold star, we want to check off that box or be recognized as this kind of congregation or that kind of congregation, and there's nothing wrong with that. Except for the fact that it can become a goal in itself, so that, you know, you can say that I did this anti-racism training or that, and now I'm with the cool kids. I've done everything. Yes, exactly. You know, I did that 5 years ago. I don't need to learn anything. And then that becomes a barrier to progress, actually. What my hope is that people will come with their eyes and their minds and their hearts opened, and that from this we can continue to build. I'd say it's only the beginning, and I would like to push against the idea that every year or every other year we have to completely redo our network of social justice commitments because we've changed to another theme or focus. There's enough inside of the Black Lives Movement that touches on immigration, that touches on income inequality, that touches on health care, that touches on reproductive justice. Like, it's all, you know, and how can we just bring all of that inside to be seen from, you know, through the lens of Black lives and helping that be relevant. So I'm looking forward to, you know, this being the jumping off point. We've got a Justice General Assembly coming up next year in New Orleans. What an opportunity. We're going to be in deep in the South. We're looking now to see what are the possibilities to lift up and really get powerfully related to the heritage of slavery throughout the country, and particularly in the South. So we're trying to set the stage for that as well.
Yeah.
So it sounds like there is some kind of long view visioning that is going on in conjunction.
Absolutely. Yeah. And just really quickly, I would add as another goal that, you know, whoever you are, whatever your identities, I think racial justice or justice work is not something that you achieve. It's something that you strive for. That as soon as, you know, even as, you know, Carlton and I are both cisgender Black men, and there's always ways in which we need to move back to amplify other voices. And so as soon as we say, like, oh, we're Black Lives Matter organizers, we have arrived, like, no, when it comes to gender privilege, and in my case, sexuality privilege, and I think, you know, that there's just always, like, more work to be done. And so I think we want to create a people, a faith of strivers, of folks always striving to be allies rather than saying, like, we are, you know, we are helpful. Like, no, let's wait and find out if we actually are.
Right, know? Right. We can't really know now. Let's, yeah. Mm-hmm. We'll have to look at this in the rearview mirror. Yeah. I know that for New Orleans, that some of the people involved in planning that are already thinking about kind of the message of what it's not going to be. That, like, the way I heard it phrased was, New Orleans is not Las Vegas, you know, because a lot of people are like, oh, GA, New Orleans, woohoo, Mardi Gras. Are there any sort of no, it's not going to be that messages that you feel need to be given about this GA? You know, like, white people, this is not about you, or, you know, whatever.
Messages like that. I think that it's going to be an eye-opening General Assembly for everyone who's involved. I think it's going to be challenging for everyone who's involved as well. So it's not. I think I would say it's not going to be a snoozer GA. Not that there's anything wrong with snoozing. Snoozing can be very comforting at times. But people are going to need to come, you know, awake and aware, and not taking things for granted. I mean, and really, you know, being mindful of what they say and what they do, not in sort of like an overly anxious way, but just bring like another level. I'd encourage people to bring like another level of consciousness to it. I think, you know, it's going to be very thick with activists, people who are committed to justice, people who are who have committed their lives to doing this work as well. We've got some wonderful music that we're looking forward to hearing from Reverend Sekou, who's a minister with the Bi-Brethren Fellow with the Fellowship of Reconciliation, doing amazing work in Ferguson and Minneapolis, all over the country. So I'd say, you know, come, you know, prepare to be inspired, to be challenged, and to be open.
Carlton, is there going to be now, as part of GA, a Black Lives View track every year? So will this start in Columbus and continue in New Orleans?
Well, that remains to be seen. I think now's the time, you know, to begin to have those conversations. Remarkable to think that, you know, this conversation about a Black Lives track at GA didn't really start until September, I think it was, or September, maybe late August. So this has all come together very quickly. I think there's a case to be made for, you know, for sure. And I would hope that and there's always been you know, programming that's dealt with racial justice and social justice inside of GA and microaggressions and different other aspects of it. But I do think that there's an opportunity with the Black Lives focus now to continue to build upon it. I can't foresee in our lifetime that it's ever going to be irrelevant. So hopefully so.
So one of the kind of jokes that isn't really a joke about Unitarian Universalism is, you know, if there's a problem, we throw a book at it. But books can be good things. There any, for someone who really wants to just dive in and get the most out of this, is there any pre-GA homework that you would recommend?
Yeah, so there's a few on my end. I think there's a lot of, there's several UU World articles by Black folks and other people of color, like, you know, so I think for me a lot of it is engaging with voices of the voices of people. So there's the piece that Rosemary Bray McNatt wrote for UU World like 5.5 years ago that made the rounds again pretty recently. And it just, I think what's important is to be listening to the voices of those most at the center and most affected by this work and those who are doing this work. I really do think very highly of Engaging with Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates, that I feel like that book, you know, it's almost like become the cool book to read, but it doesn't mean that it's not useful.
It's informational.
And it's not, because it's not particularly hopeful, but it's real. I mean, it's just like, and so those are just off the top of my head. And also there's, you know, there's videos of people like Lena Gardner and Leslie Mack flying around. So that's what I would say. Yeah,
and off the top of my head, a classic book that I would add to that list that just popped into my head is Audre Lorde's Sister Outsider.
Oh, yeah.
Where she's ahead of her time in just like so many ways. But in terms of like her speeches and essays, it's a collection of speeches and essays by her. She's a Black lesbian feminist poet. Who wrote beautifully and was really articulating, I think, a lot of the sentiments that we are and feelings that we're engaging with now. So yeah, that would be another one to come on.
Which reminds me, one very last suggestion is to read women and feminist critiques of Coates' book. There's a woman, I think her name, first name is Brittany, but who wrote this incredible, incredible critique. I want it for New Yorker, one of the New York, I grew up in Texas, I don't get New York, but anyway, one of the New York publications wrote this 2,500 word response to Coates' book about the lack of women voices in, you know, that it's a story that's about men and boys, and that that has value. And so if you've already, so if you're a listener who's already read Coates' book, find some feminist responses that, that can further your understanding of the varying levels of this work.
Very important.
Oh, great. I'm actually going to do that as soon as we go off the air. Thank you both so much for joining us this morning and really kind of laying out a vision of what people can hope for and look forward to this summer. As always, great having you here. Any last thoughts?
Keep striving. Yeah, for me it's keep striving. That I try never to think that I've arrived, and I encourage other folks to never think they've arrived as feminists, as anti-racists, as whatever. That there's a value in that. To keep pushing.
Right. A big thank you. Behind the chalice is Lori Stone Sertoski, who has been guiding us and working the tech. Thank you. And look forward to seeing y'all next week here on The View.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.